Bat Segundo here, and I wish to respond to recent news. Yes, indeed, I was arrested for littering last week, but I didn't litter. You see, I was standing just outside a nude beach where I had hoped to ingratiate myself with several other naked people and perhaps get a little lucky. I don't know. I had never been to a nude beach before. Well, I got out of my car and I took off my coat. Understand that it was very hot, much hotter than I had expected. And there was the matter of gradually removing layers, eventually stomaching up the nerve to bear my all. I'm a bit sensitive about my particular anatomy. Well, no sooner had I removed my coat when a squad car pulled up. I feared that they were going to crack down on the many people prancing around in the buff. It turns out that they were after me. They told me that throwing my coat down on the beach was littering, and they cuffed me and hauled me away. They didn't even bother to read my Miranda rights. Well, thankfully, I have a very good attorney who will defend me. He's good because his rates are fairly affordable. I stumbled upon his services while watching a late-night infomercial. But none of this really matters, because this week, our guest is none other than cartoonist Tom Tomorrow. Mr. Tomorrow, who sometimes goes by the name Dan Perkins, and I think a few other names which I won't mention because of legal obligations, is the author of Hell in a Handbasket, a phrase that I most certainly can relate to. Our young roving correspondent talked with Mr. Tomorrow yesterday. Well, actually a lot longer than yesterday. It may have been last week or last month. I don't know, I've never been very good with time. Well, whatever the case, we'll let our listeners determine when our young roving correspondent talked with Tom Tomorrow. Most assuredly, it was not tomorrow.
Okay, I am here with cartoonist Dan Perkins, also known as Tom Tomorrow, whose recent book, Hell in a Handbasket, collects his comic strip, This Modern World. Tom, Dan, how are you doing? How should I refer to you?
Hey, good. However you want. I get referred to in a lot of ways.
Okay.
Not all of them kind.
Well, I wanted to first of all talk about these strips. Your cartoons are sort of stacked to the nines. We have a lot of text. Now, when you devise one of these cartoons, what comes first, the text or the imagery?
Oh, I think fairly obviously the text. I have to write it and then I have to write it and make sure the text fits in and then see how thin the little ribbon of space for the cartoon actually is.
Yeah.
It's just the writing is what drives it. I'll lay it out and I'll look at it and I'll think about whether it works or whether I need to break it up or cut it down some more. But that's definitely the first thing.
Well, the other thing, too, is that I wanted to talk about sort of the static imagery you have.
Mm-hmm.
And you often have like a repetitive kind of image, almost a kind of clip art effect in your strips where, you know, but at the same time, sometimes you get really ambitious. Like, for example, there's the one cartoon in here that's there's the Republican Matrix, there's the mm-hmm. Twilight Zone, mm-hmm. there's also the Mobius strip in this.
Yeah, the Mobius strip was, and in fact, as hard as I worked on that one, several people immediately pointed out that it's not a true Mobius strip. Like somehow I didn't get the twist right.
Well, what sort of, you know, do you have any kind of, what kind of causes you to sort of make a very sort of staticky sort of strip versus a kind of more visual sort of strip?
I think it's the same answer. I think it's writing driven. I guess it breaks down into two parts. It's whatever the writing demands, mm-hmm. for one thing. And I also try to mix it up week to week. I mean, I don't want to be, you know, Mr. Clipart who's just doing the same look every single week. I want people not, you know, I want to mix it up. I'm not a great artist, but occasionally I do like to stretch my own limits to the extent that I can and do something fun and visually interesting because that's also a large part of my background.
Sure. Well, the other thing, too, that's interesting is that you made the move into color from black and white in around early 2000. I was wondering what sort of, maybe you can kind of elaborate on how you actually go ahead and draw a strip. Like, how many hours does it take, and what kind of, what tools did you use to sort of move into color?
Well, since about 1999, I've been entirely digital, so I create this whole thing on a Wacom drawing tablet, which is this, it's a little drawing board that I hold in my lap and has a special pen that, you know, it's a really great tool. You can the line thickness actually responds to the amount of pressure that you use on the tablet. So once you get used to using it, it really is just like using pen and ink, or even better, because it's much easier to correct your mistakes, and I make a lot of them in the course of it. And you know, so once I have it written, I'll probably, you know, even like with the stuff that is just sort of using stock images that I've already got, you'd think that would be really easy. But even then, I seem to end up going back and sort of, you know, redrawing them or adjusting the line thickness or whatever it is. So it's kind of the stupidest possible way to work, because it should be really efficient. But even at that, I just kind of enjoy fiddling around with it and getting it so that, you know, doing all these little things that no one else will ever even notice, but that, you know, satisfy me that I'm doing the work I want to be doing.
We were talking about how you sort of moved into color.
Oh, color. That was it. You'll have to forgive me. I've been on tour all week, and I'm a little sleepy and foggy, so if I forget what I'm talking about.
No, you're doing a great job given the sort of crazy schedule I saw personally today.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. So the color thing just was because I wanted to, you know, once I started working more in Photoshop and what have you, I wanted to do a color version for the online publication would be the wrong word, but you know, my online clients like Salon,
yeah,
being the main one. I wanted to, you know, I've always liked working in color. It's fun. You can do a whole lot of different stuff. If you look in there, the Time Machine cartoon, you know, with the swirling colors as he's going into the distant future of like 3 days ahead or whatever it is that I've got. You know, these are effects that are much harder to achieve in black and white. So what it initially happens is that I get the basic black line down, and the black line being the characters, the text, and so forth. And then I have two different versions, and one of them I just, you know, the little dots that I use, the shade in the black and white version, before the computer, that was actually stuff that came on these little adhesive sheets, and you would cut it out with an X-Acto knife and lay it down. So I still think of it as Zip-A-Tone, even though it's now just digital stuff. But, you know, that I paste, you know, I delineate and paste that into the appropriate places on the black and white version, which goes out to newspapers. Mm-hmm. And then the color version, I, you know, go back to the same piece of artwork and add color.
So how many hours does, like, one particular sort of strip entail?
From trying to come up to concept to finished and distributed, it's generally Monday morning to Wednesday night.
Okay. Now, what do you do? What are your informational sources? I mean, it seems to me like your blog is actually very similar to Warren Ellis's blog. In the sense that he uses...
I like his writing. I didn't know he was blogging.
He does. He uses his blog, though, as a way to kind of log these kinds of associations.
And yeah.
It's a way for him to sort of think about the various sort of things and then percolate into, like, a comic.
Yeah, I don't know if I would have actually... thought to put it that way, but I think that is pretty much what I'm doing too. And it actually does, you know, if I put it up a lot of the time, it means that it's something that, you know, I mean, whatever, you're blogging, sometimes you just put something up because you think it's silly or whatever, but when there are certain significant things that I almost use my own blog as a memory touchstone. I can go back and look at, you know, didn't I say something about such and such, or don't I remember reading a story, and I can just search my own blog and find it, you know?
Well, also, going back to your comics, what steps do you sort of take to ensure that you don't repeat yourself. Like I notice, for example, like on your six panel strips, you have often that sort of the fifth silent panel, and it actually that reminds me very much of Boondocks. Actually, how you have like the three panel.
Oh, but you know, I've been doing. I mean, we basically both stole it from Gary Trudell. I've certainly been doing it since Aaron Magruder was in diapers. So, well, but as I say, we both stole it from Gary Trudell.
I don't want.
In fact, do you know Reuben Bowling? Do you know that cartoonist?
I don't, unfortunately.
He occasionally has this thing in his cartoon, Tom the Dancing Bug, where he just makes up other comics, fictional comics, and one of them is the comic strip entirely composed of the pause panel. And so it's just characters paused, looking at each other.
it's sort of reminiscent of that the New Yorker cartoon contest that's been circulating online.
Oh, what I haven't said, you know, did they do that? I have meant to do that. Did they take those? Tell me about this.
Well,
what are they doing?
Okay, well, what happened is that, you know, the New Yorker ran like a caption contest.
They do this a lot. Yeah, they do this like every other issue issue.
But this got appropriated by a lot of the online people. And they basically just took every sort of New Yorker cartoon and put like, fuck you, asshole, at the bottom of each. And it made sense. It's like basically, here's your New Yorker cartoon. Insert this phrase into any sort of New Yorker
cartoon. No, that's
great.
I'm both happy and sad to hear that because I've been meaning to do that myself on my blog. I've been wanting to run my own New Yorker caption contest because... but I would want to do it a little more than just fuck you. I would want to have them. The real trick would be writing the caption that almost makes sense but doesn't, you know, and makes you laugh. So it has to be a non sequitur that makes you laugh, yet somehow seems as if it has some relation to the drawing. Mm-hmm. That would be my ideal.
Well, we were kind of talking initially about Doonesbury, but what were some of your other influences? And again, I was kind of initially asking you the question of what steps do you take as an artist to ensure that you don't repeat yourself or that you try – what kind of experimental things do you attempt?
Well, I think for one thing, I am going to repeat myself. I think that's just inevitable.
Sure.
You know, I reinvent myself in each cartoon a lot more than a lot of cartoonists. I mean, if you look at most daily cartoonists, take away the dialogue and they're essentially, you know, 90% of them are the very same cartoon day to day. You know, every morning they're you know,
certain strips about fat cats, for example.
Yeah, well, or, you know, certain strips about little kids watching television or whatever it may be. There are a lot, or certain strips about office workers, you know, behind desks. I mean, there are a lot of cartoons that are, you know, and you know, what else are these guys going to do? They have to do this 5 days a week. That's not meant to be a criticism.
Sure.
I've got a little more leeway, so I do try to really mix it up and reinvent it. But, you know, every time I have a straightforward cartoon with Sparky talking to Biff, I just kind of log it in my head and think, okay, I don't want to do this again for like 2 months, you know. And if you look through there, you know, I'll bet you two things. I'll bet you that you think I do that more often than I do. And I bet if you look through that book, you'll realize how rarely I actually do it.
In fact, actually, I did, in fact, notice that. But even like turning Sparky into a Republican, you know?
Yeah, well, that was just, that one ended up ultimately not going anywhere. I just kind of eventually turned him back. I thought that, I played with that for a while, and then I just ran out of things to do with it. So it never really had a very satisfying conclusion. It just kind of ended.
Going back to this issue of like the comic strip involving office workers, I should note that you were doing this well before that, when in the early incarnation of this modern world.
Yeah. I mean, he's had a lot of success, and you know, God bless him. It's a fine, funny comic strip. Mm-hmm. So,
but I was looking at a lot of these early strips, and the thing that was interesting to me was that there is the commonality of like 1950s sort of comic archetypes here, and also the text itself had that kind of 1950s almost Edward Murrow kind of sort of like, you know, exposition. At the same time, it's like a radically sort of different topic, since we're dealing from, you know, anti-office, anti-corporate to, well, anti-corporate but more political and more based off of these.
Oh, wait, are you talking about my transition?
Yes, or,
transition. Yeah, you know, I early on I didn't really expect that I was going to be a political cartoonist. That wasn't what I set out to be. Mm-hmm. But I just really, the first Gulf War is what kicked the whole thing off. I was really pissed off and thought, oh, if only I had a platform with which to express my anger. And
yeah.
then a little light bulb went off over my head. Oh, I mean, you know, it had been, the cartoon had flirted with politics quite a lot before that, but there's up to that point, I don't think there's any way you would have described it as a political cartoon. It was just kind of this weird experimental thing that oftentimes probably made no sense whatsoever. It just got a lot more focused, and I really kind of found my rhythm and figured out what I was good at.
But even the typeface for this modern world, like at the very top or whatever, is the same as it has been.
Yeah, you know, but that I that's a typeface called Baby Tooth, and it's a classic deco typeface. Mm-hmm. You see it on a lot of 30s buildings here in San Francisco, which is where we are taping this. There used to be a pharmacy called the Hub Pharmacy. Right at the foot of, I think where Haight Street runs into Market, or down on Market somewhere, where there's kind of a triangle of streets.
Oh, yeah.
And right now there's this kind of little triangular building. Actually, I haven't seen it on this trip, but the last time I was here, the little triangular building was a frame shop, do-it-yourself framing. But when I first moved to San Francisco, it was the Hub Pharmacy, and they had that deco typeface in their logo, and I just saw that, and I thought that's what I want to do. I tried actually changing the logo once, and people complained, and I agreed with them. It looked wrong to me too, so I put the old one back.
Gotcha. Now, I was going, since we're talking about lettering, I was wondering, in your move to digital, did you digitize your own sort of lettering?
Yeah, I did. I hired a guy to, you know, and I had to, you know, write out all the samples, and he made it into a font, and I will still play with it a little bit if it looks too repetitive to me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's an ironic thing, because it wouldn't somehow, I mean, it's entirely digital, and a lot of cartoonists are going very digital, and yet it wouldn't look like a real cartoon unless you had this hand-lettered look to it. But it's like a fake hand-lettered look, but it's not fake, because it's based on my own hand lettering.
Yeah.
So I don't know if future cartoonists are going to have to learn to hand letter in order to create their own font, in order to digitize it, in order to have the fake hand lettered font, you know, it's just kind of it's one of those small ironies of technology.
But I also understand there was this very authoritative review of you, interview with you by Steve Rhodes, and he indicated that early on you actually really weren't very much of a technology person.
That's true.
What sort of shifted this kind of change? The inevitable march of progress?
Or? It really was the inevitable march of progress. Early on, the only technology I used was the photocopier, and everything else was, you know, hand done and pen and ink and paper. And you know, at a certain point, it just, you know, the papers that I run started wanting digital files. And people kept pointing out the things that I'd be able to do if I had, you know, I mean, I didn't even own a computer a computer that I could work on for anything more than, you know, email or whatever till like 1999. But frankly, looking back on it, that was really the first point at which computers had just started to be powerful enough, you know, to be able to handle what I was doing. I mean, these image files are huge. Mm-hmm. And, before that, I would have just been sitting and watching the little clock dial go round and round and round. In fact, when I first started working in Photoshop, I didn't fully understand what I was doing, but I had an assignment, I think, for the New Yorker right away. And the idiots in their art department said, I don't know how well you know Photoshop, but I'll just speak as if you do understand it, because somebody listening to this will know, and everyone else can just be bored. Fast forward.
I've got a really dependable sort of basics. So,
but anyway, the people at the New Yorker told me I had to keep everything in layers and not combine it down. And when you keep things in layers, it might make it slightly easier for some fucking $5 an hour paste up person.
Yeah.
But what it meant for me that night is I literally stayed up 24 hours straight. I was Jack Bauer, except I was only sitting at a computer and doing artwork. But because I had a 1999, I couldn't even tell you what kind of memory it had on it, but it was a 1999 top of the line Apple Tower. And since I was running Photoshop and the idiots at the New Yorker told me not to combine layers, I had to wait like a half hour at the time while it would process various things.
Oh, wow.
And so that was pretty maddening.
Oh, crazy.
But that was just because of stupidity. But even given that, you know, that computer was a lot slower than what I'm working on today.
Sure.
And if I had started any sooner than that, I don't know this for a fact. And when you're talking about computers, there's always someone who will email in and say, sorry, you are very wrong. If you had bought a such and such, then in this case, you would have been fine. And I don't really want to get that email because I really don't give a shit. But, you know, I started at a fine time with it. And then now I'm pretty well versed in it.
Okay. Do you miss anything about the sort of analog days? Or?
Yeah, I miss the hands-on stuff. I really do. And I miss like holding, I miss having a physical original that I held in my hand, which, you know, does not exist anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a certain nostalgia for the whole thing, but this is just how I work now. It's what I'm used to doing now.
Well, I wanted to talk to you, actually, because there was one cartoon in this particular collection that kind of seemed to me almost kind of a comment upon this, but you have in Hell in a Handbasket, there's the Fluffy Bunny and Happy Mouse cartoon. Now,
yes.
There is an obvious reference to Teletubbies, but it also reminded me very much of it was kind of like almost a veiled reference to Happy Tree Friends.
Well, see, I don't know that. What I was trying with that cartoon, it just struck me that people who were talking about how great things were going in Iraq,
yeah,
had about the same view of reality as the Teletubby type characters on the children's shows that my son was watching at the time. And so I was just trying to come up with the moronic children's show in which everything's great in Iraq, even because it was right when we had heard about the torture and all of this.
Yeah.
And just that insanely optimistic, everything's going to be fine thing that you kept hearing and still hear from the right-wing blogs. It just stuck me, you know, they were, you know, I wasn't specifically thinking of Teletubbies, but that's a fine way to put it. You know, these right-wing bloggers were effectively Teletubbies, you know?
Sure.
But if you look at those characters, Fluffy Bunny and Happy Mouse, and they came back after Katrina, although that's not in this book, they were, I think they were working for FEMA.
Sure.
But if you look at those characters, I designed them, deliberately designed them so that they were almost cute, but really disturbing. Like I deliberately designed them as if they were badly designed, if that makes sense, by a bad, some bad animator somewhere. Because if you look at them, they're just disturbing. It's like they're supposed to be cute. They're like some kind of Japanese import that's supposed to be cute, but just seems wrong somehow.
Complete with a sort of either the Comic Sans sort of disturbing font too. That
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it kind of, I didn't know if it might have been a reference to Happy Tree Friends, because I also wanted to ask you about the Mondo mini show situation, where This Modern World was in fact going to be turned into some sort of flash cartoon along the lines of their lineup, and yet it never really sort of
No, that was on for a long time.
Oh,
for like
okay.
a year or a year and a half.
Really?
Yeah.
What happened with that?
The money ran out, I guess. We stopped doing them. I think basically the money ran out. I mean, did Is Mondo still in business?
They still are, but only with Happy Tree Friends.
Yeah. It was just,
I was trying to access these and I couldn't.
Oh, they're not online anywhere right now.
Yeah.
There are some contractual business things to sort out, and I also, about half of them really suck. So I just kind of want to sort through and figure out which ones I would actually want to post again. The ones that suck, everybody's out of luck, you know. That's the beauty of the internet. I get to to make them vanish.
Now you wrote all these, or
with my partner in that particular project was
okay.
a guy named Harold Moss, who handled a lot of the animation and was also a pretty good collaborative creative partner. So we came up with a lot of them together and got very silly with it.
Did any of this sort of influence the strip in any way? Or?
Not really, honestly. Obviously, a lot of these were, it's much more the other way around, because a lot of these were taken from the strip and expanded. But I have a character who comes in occasionally, who's this crazy scientist named Wilbur von Filbert. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he was only from the earliest cartoons, and then I hadn't used him in a long time, and we started using him in the animation. So the look of him and the fact that I was using him was directly due to the animation.
Well, it also seems to me that it would be very difficult to like maintain the sort of static panel approach and transpose that to animation.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a problem that all cartoonists face. Yeah. Like, I haven't seen a lot of them, but my friend Max Cannon is doing something with Flash right now, and you know, in his is a very static. His is, you know, his makes mine look like a sweeping vista. But they've totally changed it for the Flash. Like, they've totally expanded it, made it into this whole world with the whole Flash look that those cartoons have, you know. But we did try to sort of keep a certain homage to it. I mean, not, you know, everyone, there was a certain amount of, like people's heads didn't actually tend to turn from right to left. You know, they tended to stay in the same position. And Blinky, the very nice dog, became a fairly major character. And we never showed Blinky standing up. Blinky always sat down, because if you notice in the cartoon, Blinky is always in the same position.
Yeah.
And that was kind of an homage to that static thing. And so when we did have to have Blinky moving, Blinky would hop along in a sitting position, which was just so stupid.
Very much,
but
like
it was, yeah. So that was what we did there.
Very much. I guess you took a sort of, you know, which a lot of Flash cartoons do, sort of a cutout cartoon sort of approach.
Yeah, and actually ours less than a lot of them. I was kind of the executive overseeing type. I wasn't actively day-to-day art directing, and in a lot of ways, I mean, this is a problem I have. A lot of Flash stuff all looks the same to me, I guess because of whatever the technique is that you're using, and so that a lot of my stuff kind of, I feel like my stuff got turned into Flash stuff rather than the other way around.
Well, going back to your current strip, what's going on, are there any particular topics you would not actually do a strip about?
Oh, I'm sure there are, but nothing springs immediately to mind, because the stuff I wouldn't do a strip about is the stuff that I'm not really thinking about, if that makes any sense. If the stuff that I'm not interested in is the stuff that I wouldn't do a strip about.
But do you set any sort of conscious limitations at all?
No. I mean, I'm sure they're there. I'm sure they're there. But what I'm trying to say is I don't have any specific, oh, no, can't go there sort of things. So just if there is such a thing, like you know, I'm not, I'm not going to do it because I don't want to do it. You know, I mean, I'm not going to do a cartoon praising the joys of necrophilia or something just in order to be shocking, you know?
Yeah. Do you put any sort of, you know, beneficial limitations upon yourself? I mean, you sort of kind of do with the sort of static panel sort of approach, or the fifth panel approach. I mean, sometimes that might actually be more conducive to emphasizing the text.
Oh, no, you mean the pause panel?
Yeah, I
think that the text is emphasized by having that break. It's a timing thing. You know, if I were writing for TV or something, I would do it in different ways. I would just have people pausing and looking, you know, I would have the same thing, but you would just have a second. It's that beat. Every comedian understands the beat.
Yeah.
You know, you pause for the beat, then tell the punchline. And that's kind of my version of doing that.
Now, you also, I should point out, you were in for about 6 months, U.S. News and World Report.
Yeah.
What was the specific objection by Mort Zuckerman that kind of got you out of there?
Well, I think the specific objection by Mort Zuckerman was that I should not be in his magazine.
Okay.
I think it's nothing more complicated than that. I think he looked at that and thought, what the fuck is this? And got me out of there as quickly as they reasonably could do so.
Do you fear that maybe your strips may not go out to enough mainstream audiences?
Or? Yeah, you know, there's a danger that you're just going to be sort of ghettoized and marginalized. I mean, you know, on the one hand, it seems to me sometimes, gosh, there's a lot of readers, and you know, that's a really good thing. But yeah, you want to break those boundaries. You want to reach out to new audiences, and that's when you get a book out. That's one chance to do this, and that's kind of what's such a drag that places like The Daily Show and The Colbert Report are ghettoizing me, because they certainly have far more obscure guests than me. And this, I say this acknowledging that I'm pretty obscure.
Yeah.
And, you know, one TV hit like that would really, really help open up new audiences. And I really like those shows and respect the intelligence behind them. And it kind of breaks my heart that that's not a two-way street.
Why do you think that they're sort of...
I couldn't even speculate. You would have to ask them. I couldn't even tell you.
Have you tried approaching them again, saying, hey, look, this will probably be beneficial for your show?
Oh, sure, no, sure. We've certainly approached... I have publicists working for me on this tour. We've certainly approached them. They've said no.
Do you worry about preaching to the converted?
Not excessively. I get enough email from people who... feel that they were exposed to new ideas through the cartoon that I don't think it's not as if everyone even in the audience today in there, it's not as if everyone was, you know, in some rigid party line ideological, you know, like people are not robots.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of range of belief. Like, I actually worry when I read a strip out loud called The Sensible Liberal, which is about the people who, you know, just really were persuaded by Colin Powell's presentation and thought we really did to go to war in Iraq. And I feel actually there's part of me, and this is probably not something that you would expect, but I feel a little bit bad when I'm reading that. I'm hoping that there actually aren't any sensible liberals in the audience.
Yeah.
You know, I actually, you know, fundamentally, like, it's not really about Joe Average, the newspaper reader, sitting there in the audience. It's about, you know, specific bloggers and specific pundits and things like this who really pissed me off. But I, you know, mainly I would say if preaching to the choir is a bad thing, then why does anyone go to church on Sunday? You know, you gotta maintain the choir or the flock or whatever, as well as reach out of the church. They certainly understood that, in the Baptist church that I grew up in.
But at the same time, though, when you're dealing with something like the sensible liberal, it's kind of like a gray area, because if someone did in fact support the war early on and now sees that it is sort of a failure, then maybe they might be sort of, you know, disappointed in themselves, but at least maybe you'll plant a seed in terms of, like, well, maybe I should sort of, you know, think these issues a little bit more carefully.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? So in a sense, I guess, I don't necessarily see it necessarily as a bad thing.
Like, yeah.
Well, the guilt, though. I mean, you feel that you're talking about
little, you know, tiny, okay. Tiny. Okay. I wouldn't overstate it.
Really quickly, because I know we have to wrap this up soon. But I wanted to kind of talk about the origins of the characters, particularly like the bearded liberal. where did this come from exactly?
Well, you know, that's an interesting progression. He was initially based on Eric Alterman in the mid '90s when Alterman was, I felt, kinder to Bill Clinton than Bill Clinton deserved, and so I just introduced this character and had Sparky yelling at him. So he wasn't actually meant to be a sympathetic character, and it's actually the progression of the bearded liberal actually sort of parallels the progression of my my feelings about Alterman, that we're actually friends now, and I'm actually much more sympathetic to him now than I was in those days, and to his point of view. And the bearded liberal has also become a much more sympathetic character, because once Bush was elected, just having Sparky in there, like, you know, I needed somebody else besides Sparky who could also, you know, be the foil or speak from the liberal perspective. And also, you know, but the bearded liberal became less and less Alterman and more sort of the beset upon the college professor who was being blamed for all the ills, or the sort of just token liberal who was just, you know, very frustrated. He's not quite a hardcore lefty. Like, he sort of reflects mainstream. He's not really a sensible liberal either.
Yeah.
He sort of reflects just kind of average. Like, right after 9/11, he was just biting his tongue and taking all the insults because we all had to stand together. And then, you know, another year later, he finally just started saying, no, I'm tired of this. And it really basically, if you chart the bearded liberal, he sort of you have a chart of how sort of mainstream liberals were reacting to conservatives at first, just, you know, kind of being quiet and you know, trying to stand together as one because we're all Americans, and then sort of saying no, I'm tired of this. You have to stop, and just getting more outspoken. I actually think he's a much more sympathetic character now.
Now, did you find coming up with humor after the re-election of Bush was a problem? Because I noticed this cartoon here, like this is extremely, extremely sparse.
Yeah.
I think this is pretty much all liberals were sort
well,
of
Well, I'll read
and,
this.
And not only that, but also it's black, jet black here.
No, this was the first cartoon after, it can't have been the first one because this
one
is probably the first one, but it was right afterwards. Biff, the Republican, says to Sparky, you know what your problem is? You're completely out of touch with Americans who believe that abortion should be criminalized and that homosexuality is a sin against God. And then you just have two of what we've been referring to as the pause panel, and Sparky, which gives it that extra emphasis. Sparky just stares at him for two panels and then finally says, you say that like it's a bad thing. And yeah, I remember writing this. I remember this, you know, after this, this was probably a week or two after the election because people keep saying, exactly this. Democrats are out of touch with America.
Yeah.
And I just expanded on that, that Democrats are out of touch with Americans who want to make abortion illegal and want to make homosexuality illegal.
Sure.
Because that was effectively what I thought they were saying. And yeah, I mean, as I say, you know, this just seemed like the way to do this cartoon. Sparse seemed the way to do it. But yeah, the logo in all black does seem like it was probably a little mourning or something, a little symbol of mourning.
Well, I can tell you here that you know, that night, it was just here in San Francisco, it was so utterly silent. I mean, literally, I never heard a silence like that, not since September 11th, possibly, you know, where people were just like moping around in shock.
It was, yeah, I remember San Francisco when the first George Bush was definitively defeated, and there were cheers in the streets as if somebody had just won the Super Bowl or something.
Sure. Oh, I wanted to ask you, why does Cheney have a red mark on his forehead?
Oh, you know, that's not meant to be a red. What's that? Cheney, you know, with all his heart attacks and everything, strikes me as a guy who probably gets really red in the face, and you know that's all that's meant to indicate is just that incipient, you know, rage that could turn into a heart attack at any moment because he's so pissed off all the time. And, you know, that sort of thing. That's all that's trying to indicate.
Great. Well, Dan, Tom, whoever you are today, thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.